Welcome back to The Roundtable. I'm Ian Pickus. Fifty years ago, a motley crew of Bay Area musicians came together from diverse backgrounds, classical music, jug bands, bluegrass, and formed the group that would become the Grateful Dead. From their decades on the road and unique sound to the community that grew up around them, they were quite simply one of America's most influential bands, whose imprint is still felt today. But for the band that always had one more Saturday night, the Golden Road is ending in Chicago, site of its last concert with Jerry Garcia in 1995, for three final concerts over the 4th of July weekend, dubbed Fare Thee Well. With Deadheads looking forward and backward this summer, author David Brown is out with a new history of the band called So Many Roads, The Life and Times of the Grateful Dead. We last spoke 4 years ago upon the publication of his previous book, Fire and Rain. Brown says he delved deep into the world of Dancing Bears in the time since.
It was kind of, I hate to say long, strange trip. It wasn't that strange, but it was long. I will say that. I discovered them as a kid back in the 70s and, you know, started buying their records right away and then saw them live in concert with Jerry in, starting in the 80s a few times. And I think what happened was that a couple of years ago, after I finished my last book, Fire and Rain, which was all about, you know, 1 year, 1970, in rock and roll and the culture, I thought, well, gee, what would I like to do next? And, you know, part of me, I had such a good time writing Fire and Rain and writing about all this music and all these bands that I first grew interested in when I was a kid, that I part of me wanted to kind of stay in that zone. And I sort of flashed on the Dead, because they, along with Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young and the Beatles and so forth and other bands that I covered in Fire and Rain, the Dead were another one of those really early bands that I discovered and was into. And I thought, well, that would be fun. But then I thought, well, what could I possibly add to this? And I decided to take the same somewhat narrative, novelistic approach that I took with, that I've tried to take with all my books, and pick out certain days of their saga and flesh out each day and make the book maybe perhaps a bit more of an episodic read. And so that took a couple of years. So, you know, it's been a long road since the 70s, but I finally was able to write about them.
You know, this, I'm sure, presents a different kind of challenge. A lot of times music writers are trying to unearth information that's not available. With the Grateful Dead, they're one of the most, you know, widely archived bands around, with a lot of, you know, recorded music, a lot of personalities, a lot of hangers-on, and a lot of other writings about the group. How did you drill down into the book that we have now?
Well, it started with getting it started with reaching out to the band who I'd interviewed on and off for various stories for Rolling Stone over the last few years, and saying, "Well, I'd like to do a book on you guys and be the next person to tackle this saga." And you know, how do you feel about that? And you know, the feedback came back to me that they were fine with that and good luck, you know, and that was really helpful in opening up a lot of doors for me, both with talking with people who knew them and worked with them and were part of their inner circle, some of whom hadn't talked much before, and also giving me access to their archives, which are currently housed at the University of California in Santa Cruz. Those archives are still very much a work in progress. The archivist there is still going through boxes and boxes of material and cataloging it all by file folder and so forth, but I was able to get a peek at some of those what other work he's done so far, and I was able to see letters and personal papers and concert contracts and other documentation and recordings that other biographers haven't had access to. So between that and the sort of day by day approach that I took, I was hoping I could bring something new to the story that hasn't been there before.
I want to talk about the structure of the book, because as you mentioned before, each chapter is kind of an important day, an important moment in the history of the band. Did you intentionally structure it like a live dead show or song in that, you know, it riffs in different directions, it comes back to the middle, and then we find ourselves in maybe a new place at the end?
That wasn't intentional, but that it's funny. It's been pointed out to me a couple times that each chapter does have the kind of improvisatory quality of one of their songs. It was somewhat accidental in terms of the way each chapter is structured. It was very intentional to make each chapter about one day or one sort of pivotal group of days, and then delve deeper into that era and using that day or that era, those period of days as very representative of a period. So when I picked one, like the last show on the Europe 72 tour, which was in London, I used it as a way not just to write about that night and how they'd grown as a band with the addition of Keith and Donna Godchow, but also to show all the ways in which the machine of the Dead had already grown by then, how potent the road crew had become, how they had weathered some ups and downs in personnel, and yet they came back strong. And so I tried to use each day as a symbolic of a moment and to kind of weave back and forth. And the comparison to a Dead jam is probably the most complimentary thing I could ever imagine hearing. And it was just a result of the structure. But I'm really glad that it evokes that.
We'll talk a little bit about where the group is now as we speak. They've just marked their 50th birthday. But I want to go back to the beginning. It's hard to imagine, really, the way it came together. You actually take us into one of the early gigs in a pizza shop, and the idea that that band is still playing in some form 50 years later is really just unbelievable.
It is something kind of miraculous about that, too. I agree. And given that, especially how different each of those guys was when the band started, and how not just in their personalities, but in their musical backgrounds. I mean, these are guys who each came from a very different place. You know, Jerry had a bit of rock and roll, but a lot of bluegrass and folk in him. Phil Lesh was not a rock and roll guy and was sort of a classical and new music guy. You know, Bob Weir was more of a folk guy. Pigpen, the late Pigpen, was a total blues R&B person. Most of them had not played electric instruments until they started that band, which was the Warlocks and became the Dead. And then here they are, you know, doing their first gigs at a pizza parlor, which eventually come to an end because they're just too loud and people are trying to dance in the pizza parlor, so the pizza parlor shuts it down. The idea that those guys would endure as long as they did, 30 years with Garcia, and that 20 years after that, now 50 years after the pizza parlor, we're still celebrating their music is sort of amazing. It's kind of an amazing story that they, such an unlikely band with such unlikely contrasting influences, playing in such a strange place, would become one of the more iconic American institutions.
We're speaking with David Brown. He's the author of So Many Roads, The Life and Times of the Grateful Dead. One thing I really enjoy about your book is that you spend so much time on the music itself. How did they ultimately settle on this new sound?
I think it's a result of all those different influences and what they all kind of brought to the table. And so you would hear songs that evoked country music, or they would write songs in that style, or they would their jazz backgrounds, which some of which came from Bill Kreutzmann, a drummer who was a big fan of jazz and jazz drummers, fed into them wanting to kind of stretch out and improvise, even if they started with a country song area, which might happen, and so it was a lot of fun for me to write about the music like that, even though I'm familiar with it, but to actually delve deep into it and analyze certain songs. You know, one day that I picked is one what I thought was a particularly powerful performance of Dark Star in late 1969, and to really examine that particular version which goes on a half hour, and see how they interact minute by minute in those songs. It's like an ongoing conversation, and you hear the dynamics in the band in that performance. You hear them coming together and colliding and then kind of going into their separate corners and then slowly converging again. It's like this, it's kind of an amazing thing to kind of to dissect, and I hadn't really done that before. So when I was able to write about the music in that way, it really felt fresh and new to me, and not and different than just saying, "Hey, Casey Jones is an amazing, terrific song."
You mentioned the touring machinery that went into this group, by the 80s and 90s, they'd certainly perfected their model. But what were some of the groundbreaking things that the Grateful Dead brought to the music industry in terms of, innovations in live shows, in touring, in an organization?
Yeah, I think their impact in all those ways is still being felt. It starts with a kind of direct one-on-one contact with fans that I saw as early as 1967 when a friend of the band's had a copy of a letter that Jerry wrote to a fan who just wrote in. This was, so early in their career, and Jerry wrote back, and this long response, saying, taking that person through the history of the band and explaining, about who was who and what instruments they played, and even criticizing one of their recent performances to a total stranger in a letter. And from that to the newsletters they would send out in the 70s, written in their own voices and keeping fans up to date on what they were doing at that moment, they really paved the way, for social media in a way, and they proved that the power of that one-on-one connection with fan base and how important that is to establish. And they also were pioneers in sound systems. They really wanted the best quality sound at their shows, and there were all kinds of trial and error experiments with that up through the 70s. And by the 80s, they really had that down. They also worked with MIDI technology and all these sorts of technologies to change and improve the sounds of their instruments. We're still feeling that. They sold tickets out of their own office starting in the 80s. A lot of the DIY, the do-it-yourself aesthetic that is really flourishing now in the internet age can really be traced back to them.
There's an undercurrent of tragedy in this group, and certainly in the book. Everyone knows about Jerry Garcia, but also at the keyboard position, they lost several players.
Yeah.
What is it that's kept the group going through some really severe adversity?
Well, I think by their own admission, they were never the most sort of touchy-feely group. It's not like when something tragic would happen, they would lose one of their players. There were several deaths along the way. It was something in them, and maybe it was a kind of all-American macho in some regards, but something in them just made them just keep going and not spend too much time wallowing or mourning. And I think that was part of their own sort of internal drive as a band. I think part of it was, their increasing machinery of that touring process that you referred to earlier, that especially by the 80s, they had a lot of overhead, they had a lot of employees. It was hard for them to just shut down the operation, and they almost never did that. They had to, and they weren't averse to making a good living themselves and having BMWs as dating back to the 70s. So I think it was, all those factors combined just made them just keep moving on and not letting, tragedy really sidetrack them too much, at least until Jerry died.
Well, how would you characterize the last 20 years of the group's existence? The Survivors have played in various iterations since then, but not always happily, and oftentimes it's been in fits and starts.
It's been a fascinating process to observe. What you've been seeing the last 20 years is these four guys trying to reconnect with each other, but without the guy who was their main connection, the guy who was the glue who held them all together. And, you know, I think we've all realized, and they probably have too, how central Garcia was to things. I don't think they ever doubted that. But he was never, like, the most dominant leader. He didn't like to be seen as the leader of the band, and he wasn't a dictator by any way. But without him, you've really seen this, you've seen these guys grappling with how to relate to each other and who should lead the band without him. And everybody has a pretty strong opinion about that. And it's resulted in a lot of really ups and downs. And, you know, hopefully we won't be seeing any of that, you know, on stage in California and Chicago this summer. I doubt we will. I think they're kind of older and maybe a little wiser and mature now, and just, you know, they know that they want to give it one last shot and sort of put all the troubles behind them, at least for those shows. So,
What you're referring to is they're going to play a few final shows. They're calling it Fare Thee Well, and there's going to be, I guess, a symbolic passing of the torch with Phish's Trey Anastasio kind of sitting in the Jerry role for the final concerts. Which brings me to my next question. Do you really think this is the end of it?
They're saying it's the end of it for these four surviving core guys playing together, and they're very adamant about that. And the fact is that those four guys over the last 20 years have not played together as a foursome that much, you know, a few tours, but it's largely been either on their own or with combinations of two or three of them. So in a way, it's not surprising, but they are pretty adamant in saying this is the last time you will see these four guys together. You might see something in the future with two or three of them, and you know, given that they've been so public about that and even calling it Fare Thee Well, which they've I think it's something to be taken seriously, because they've never been that upfront about saying that. Which I think that also attributes to the crush of tickets for the shows. Because, you know, when you say that's it, and certainly, you know, we've seen so many pop music performers in the past, from Sinatra to David Bowie and so forth, quote unquote retire, and then they come back a couple of years later. But, you know, in this case, given the history those guys have, and given their ages, you know, I think it seems very likely that this will be, you know, the last time we get to see the four of them play together.
If you had to make a prediction, what do you think the last song will be?
Oh, wow. You know, there was a tradition, they would end their shows with a traditional song called Then We Bid You Goodnight, kind of an a cappella sing-along thing. I could almost see that as a really sweet ending. But I could just see something more kind of upbeat. You know, at their very last show, at the last minute, they played Box of Rain, and I can almost see them coming back to that song at the very end. A lot of possibilities, though. Possibly, yeah, who knows? Maybe even like A Touch of Grey, just because of the whole, you know, "I Will Survive, We Will Survive" lyric. That might take on a whole new resonance if it were to be the very last song they play together.
And last question, everyone's got one. You can only pick one show to listen to. What are you picking?
Oh, boy. That's really hard. That is really hard. A lot of the 1973 shows I like a lot. Maybe because they put out the record called Wake of the Flood, which I particularly love, and so they were playing a lot of those songs. Or I could go back the year later. One of the shows that I write about is the Last Night at the Lyceum Theater in London in the summer of 72, and that was such a great peak era for them. So I can listen to that one over and over again. But it's, yeah, it's hard. I mean, there were like 2,000 shows. So it's I generally tend to flash back more to a particular tour or era and just jump around in that than just one.
Well, we've been speaking with David Brown. He is the author of So Many Roads, The Life and Times of the Grateful Dead. David, it's been a pleasure to have you back on the show. Thanks for letting me put you on the spot a little bit.
Sure.
I appreciate it.
No problem. It was great talking to you again.
And you're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.